So we kind of set ourselves like we live by four pillars. The first one is all about reasonable adjustments, which is what we focus on day to day, I would say, that probably has the most benefit. The second one is about educating people, which over the past year, we have worked really, really hard on trying to educate the business and wider business on what is neurodiversity and what that really means and kind of break those stereotypes around certain conditions. The third one is about recruitment. So we look to recruit the best people as well as making it accessible for everyone. Because notoriously, the recruitment process does filter out neurodiverse people, especially if you're using those psychometric testing that people do. I know I had to do it when I started as a graduate here. It's against everything, neurodiversity, I would say. So we're trying really hard to make sure that our recruitment process is suitable for everyone. And then the last one is all about support. So supporting people, whether they are formally diagnosed, self-diagnosed, have children who have got neurodiverse conditions, or are just a general ally and want to support the wider network in neurodiversity topics.
Stay tuned to learn more about how you can prosper through the support of neurologically diverse people within your business.
At Central Piling, we have a fleet of continuous flight auger, rotary board and driven rigs of various sizes. This caters for most piling and retaining wall needs. Our team's technical, logistical and operational strengths provide clients with a flexible and reliable design and build solution across England and Wales. We pride ourselves on understanding the environment within which we work and being a responsible contractor. To ensure greater efficiency and meet our growth targets, we are always developing our people, plant and services. We now offer a plant and operator hire service, including ancillary equipment. For more details, please visit centralpiling.com or phone 01787 474 000. That's 01787 474 000.
On today's Breaking Ground podcast, we'll be discussing neurodiversity. Joining me is Gary Evans, Head of Client Engagement for Monitoring at Plowman Craven. Martin Griffin, Senior Geotechnical Engineer at Knight Piesold, and Rebecca Penn, who is a Finance Analyst at Balfour Beatty. Let's start with some of the definitions around neurodiversity. I suppose the most important place to start, Martin, is what is neurodiversity?
Good question, Steve. To me, neurodiversity is the way we think, process, move and act. We all have different brain types. It's like comparing an automatic car with an manual car or an electric car or a non-electric car. Both are cars, but they work slightly different. And our brains, how we act, you know, respond differently to different environments. And that affects our mental processes, our memory, our judgment, and emotional processes. So neurodiversity accounts for about 15% of the population, and it encompasses conditions like autism, dyslexia, dyspraxia, ADHD, Tourette's, a whole range of conditions that people will experience in life.
Yeah, so the SPLD is the specific learning disorders. Difficulties. Okay, thank you for correcting me.
Yeah.
People talk about a spectrum as well of conditions. So are those learning difficulties within the autism spectrum, or is that two separate things? You know, you hear these terms being bandied about, but I think most people will be like me and not really understanding where everything fits in, or if indeed it needs to fit into a certain place.
As a non-specialist myself, I see myself as neurodiverse on a spectrum, and it's not like a linear saying you get from A to B, or it's a progression. It's a very complex multifaceted dimensions, and say effects vary from time to time and circumstances, if that makes any sense. Probably does.
Okay.
So if we see things like going from A to B, it's not going from A to B, it's just like going from A to J, B to K, K to B. It's all going all over the place, and we have strengths in different areas. It's not just one strength in one area or one weakness in one area.
Let's just look at some of the most commonly known ones. I suppose the one that most people will be aware of is dyslexia. So that is numbers and letters, or is
just
words letters?
Words.
Words, okay.
Sometimes when you're reading, like when I'm reading, I have dyslexia, autism, dyspraxia. Dyslexia is about 15% of the population.
Okay.
Usually sometimes that account, you know, when I'm reading reports or dense reports, I have word blindness and I just cannot see, you know, see the words from the paragraphs, and it just, words just don't mean anything to me.
And that's why people would have experienced it at school or at university, colleagues that might have been given more time.
Exams, for example. Then when you're into the workplace, it's a very harsh transition almost, because you've had all this support at university and now there's not much support in an industry.
Yeah. Well, that's something I'd certainly like to come back to in a moment, but maybe if we can just look at some of the other, dyspraxia.
Dyspraxia, that's like with hand-eye coordination usually. It's often confused as clumsiness.
Okay.
You know, I've been called gait, my posture is wrong or something. It doesn't conform to whatever you consider a normal posture, which is about 8% of the population. Autism is about 1%, and I say I have autism. That is usually sort of social communication and interaction problems, and they have a specific interest. Or there's ADHD, which is like hyperactivity or attention, can't be concentrated. Dyscalculia is when you have problems with numbers and things like that.
So you mentioned autism there. Asperger's syndrome, is that a form of autism?
Yes. Autism used to be classified as severe, normal, medium, and then high-functioning autism. So severe is when you need a lot of support, like from parents or carers. High-functioning is like, if you imagine a stereotypical character like Sheldon from Big Bang Theory, that's Asperger's, and that's high-functioning autism. And that has a specific, you know, you're characterised by having a specific interest and hyper-focused. And that's one of my strengths at work. I can keep focusing on work or have that specific interest and have a fixed mindset.
Yeah, because I think a lot of the Silicon Valley companies, the high-tech businesses, I don't know if they're specifically looking for people that have Asperger's or just the two come together. They're looking for like say high functioning people. Clearly there are massive upsides from some of these conditions as well as other maybe social limitations. We've also got ADD and ADHD. I don't know if those two terms get conflated or indeed what they stand for. Can you explain a little more about those two?
That's attention hyperactivity deficit disorder. I wouldn't like to call it a disorder. I think it's just another way our brain functions. It's just another condition, often hyperactive, bursts of energy. That's how I see it. I mean, I haven't got it myself, so I can't specifically speak much about it, but I know that's how it's manifested. But And going back to about Silicon Valley, it's interesting to note that employers like GCHQ are employing a lot of autistic people because they see the value in neurodiverse staff.
See, I wonder now then whether things are starting to shift, if employers are doing that, where maybe in the past people would have been reluctant to be public about some of their conditions. Now, actually, you want to celebrate them.
Yeah, and I think we've gone through university, we've gone through, for myself at 51, I've gone through workplaces, and I feel it's time to flip the other side of the coin and say we are valuable to the workplace rather than not being misappraised or misunderstood, I would say. So we can give a full true value of diversity, diverse thought. You know, if you have diverse mindsets in a meeting or on a project, you will probably get a better solution for a client. And neurodiverse people will offer this unique insight that a non-neurodiverse person will normally achieve.
So if you could advise our listeners on where you could find more information about the different conditions within SPLDs and autism spectrum, where would you point them towards?
I'd go to Google and just have a good Google search.
Okay.
I know Google is the answer, but you know, this organization like Autism Speaks, British Dyslexia Association.
Yeah.
And maybe just Google. There's a lot of people on LinkedIn who are sort of self-advocating about the conditions, and then they can point you in other directions. And if that makes any sense, so much information.
Yeah, I suppose there is a risk though if you're going to you end up with bad information, which can be more damaging.
There's a very good CIPD report about neurodiversity in the workplace I'd recommend.
Okay. I think we'll be speaking later about some potential events events that have happened and other events that are going to be happening in the future to provide more educational opportunities around this topic. I'm going to come to Gary now for a bit of a testimony. Can you explain how you found out what the condition is, if you don't mind sharing that, and sort of how that's affected? Let's go back to kind of school days and sort of education and development, and then maybe bring it up to date with what's happening within your workplace.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a strange journey for me because most people are diagnosed at quite a young age, but I wasn't actually identified until very late in life, until I was actually 40 years old. Other members of my family do have dyslexia. But, you know, I've been to university, I've got a degree, never suspected that I had dyslexia. It was only when I started studying a postgraduate degree that things just started to be a bit strange in terms of everybody being a bit faster than me at sort of processing information and being able to do certain things. I just thought it's because I was the oldest person in the class by 10 years.
So is that only when things become extremely complex, struggle?
It's really odd, but when I had my assessment, which identified I had a specific learning difficulty, what came out of that was that I've developed lots and lots of coping mechanisms. So the way that my brain works will kind of default into working in a certain way and just kind of compensating for the dyslexia and the dyspraxia, which is what I've got. It's a mixture of the two. So, you know, I have strengths in some areas and weaknesses in others. A classic for me is, you know, mispronouncing people's names or struggling to pronounce new words. So if I can't pronounce a new word, I'll kind of chunk two words that sound very, very similar and put them together to create my own sort of Gary version of that word. And then people come back and correct me and say, no, it's this or it's that. And I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, fair enough.
Sorry, I found myself chuckling now. I suppose there is an amusement around this, but I guess for somebody that has these conditions, it maybe isn't so funny.
It depends on the person. I'm quite an open sort of person. You know, I like to divulge a lot of things. Obviously, I'm doing this podcast, so you know, I'm kind of exposing myself to the world anyway. But yeah, I think it depends on the person. You know, I think I've got quite broad shoulders, so I'm kind of used to it. But I can imagine, you know, if somebody was a bit younger and a kind of newer entry into the environment of sort of civil engineering, you know, they might not be so confident and yeah, they might take it to heart a lot more and it may affect them more. But I think I've just got, you know, thicker skin based on just being a bit older and my personality, I guess. So yeah. Just,
yeah. You know, I suppose if you've lived with it, you do condition yourself, but that's maybe not the place we want to be as a society and as an industry, that if we can provide education through things like this, you know, that
yeah.
there's an understanding, and all right, you know, we can, doesn't mean we can't have a bit of a fun with things from time to time, but you also got to treat everybody with respect to make sure that that everybody can be performing to the best of their abilities. So clearly you've already gone a long way with your career.
Yeah.
Before it was identified.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the interesting things, to be honest. Mm. I mean, you know, when I told my mum that I was dyslexic, her response was, no, you're not. my mum knows me quite well, you know. She said, no, you're not, which I thought was quite interesting until I showed her the assessment. I said, no, I am. Have a look at this. So, yeah, you know, that was a bit of a revelation, really, in some ways. But then when you sit down and think about it, it does sort of put a mirror to you and you think about how you behave and how you do things. And then when you put it into the context of the information that I've been given, just going back to a point that Martin was talking about, the question that you asked him, you know, where to get information from. I was heavily supported by University Imperial College, you know. Their disability team were really, really good. And that's because they've got dedicated, trained advisors on how to identify these things. And you know, they've got a system set up to send you off so that you can get assessed, basically. And I think, yeah, you know, that's an issue for most workplaces, especially SMEs. They don't have the knowledge and the resource sort of thing. So it's a good place to look as well, university websites. That's my
name. Oh, that's good. So, yeah, you're from an SME like myself, and, you know, it's challenging to gather all the necessary information for, you know, such a range of issues that we face as businesses. I guess you've probably been the one finding all the information and maybe educating your colleagues within the organisation. Do you think it's actually been a positive thing for it to become more common knowledge amongst your colleagues, and has there been adaptations within the business to help you?
Well, it's an interesting one, because I did declare it on my application form, and there is knowledge of neurodiversity in the business already, because there's certain people in the company who have sort of relatives who are neurodiverse as well at quite a high level. But yeah, there wasn't, pretty honest, there wasn't really much help, to be fair. It's only when I flagged this up with the article in Ground Engineering, and I shared it basically with all staff, basically. I sent a link to the article and said that, you know, it's Disability Inclusion Week, so here you go, have a read of this. So, you know, I hadn't sort of told people about it. It's only sort of recently that, you know, people in the workplace have known about it. But in terms of sort of adjustments, I kind of made my own adjustments anyway. For example, my mum asked me, what do you want for Christmas? And I asked this for a specific type of mouse. and she thought I was mad as well. But, you know, that's made a massive difference. And I didn't know about this type of mouse until I started researching, you know, different sort of
what is that? So you can zoom in to...
Yeah, it's just an old... apparently they've been around for ages, but it's just like instead of your mouse moving around, the mouse is static and you've got a roller ball on there. And that just makes it a lot easier for me to use a mouse and a computer. Ironically, like I said, I've been using a computer for a long time and not being as proficient as I could have been. And you know, just a small adjustment like that, which costs 40 quid, has made my sort of proficiency around the laptop a lot quicker and a lot easier. So that's made a big difference. Yeah. And just easy things like double screens as well. You know, when you're trying to take in information, that's one thing that somebody with dyspraxia, you know, struggles with or can become overloaded with. So if you can split things into two screens, you can kind of, you know, separate them out a bit. It's not so intense, and you can kind of work between the two, which does make a difference as well.
Great tip. Yeah.
And
so what if you feel like maybe you've got some of the... I don't know, symptoms is the right word, it's probably not, but some of the things that identify with these various conditions, what's the best way to go about actually getting a diagnosis from a medical professional? Is it literally just book something up with a GP, or is there a special...
I think there's various sort of avenues. If you're in an educational setting, which is where I was, I actually, like I said, went to the disability advisor. They did a brief sort of 30-minute check, and they went through a couple of exercises with me and said, yeah, we think there's something here. So they sent me off for a full assessment, which I did online because of COVID. Generally, you do it in person. I mean, it lasted 3 hours. I had to pay a little bit towards the assessment, about £90. but it's about £350, something like that. And, you know, University, Imperial College, you know, they paid for the bulk of that, which I'm, you know, really sort of grateful to them. And then it's quite tiring, to be fair, doing the whole thing. But at the end of it, you get a report and they tell you where your strengths and your weaknesses are, you know, where you score as a percentile compared to other people. So from an educational point, you know, that's where I push people if they're students and they listen to this podcast. In the workplace, you know, first point to HR, or if you don't have a HR, you know, director, and discuss it with them. You can Google and find people who can do the assessments. And I think you can pay for them privately, or in theory, I would expect your workplace to, you know, pay for the assessment as well, because of the Disability Act and everything that comes with that. Or you could go to one of these bodies as well, like, you know, dyslexic societies, dyspraxic societies, and then sort of ask them for advice as well on where to go. It's just another option, because you may not want to disclose it to your employer, so you might want to do it for yourself first. Again, it just depends on your relationship with your workplace and your personality, I guess, as well.
Yeah, I think that's probably quite a good point to bring Martin back in. Martin, like Gary, you're working in the geotechnical sector, of course. You've written some pretty bold articles, shall we say, in the past about some of your employers and the way the industry has, well, I don't want to speak for you. Tell me what your views are that are maybe out there without getting yourself the sack.
Very difficult today. Where do I start? Okay. I think, as Gary's alluded to, there's a lot of misunderstanding about neurodiversity and what it really is. And I think sometimes we can give it a disservice saying it's just reading and writing. When Gary's alluded to, it's like processing information, memory tasks. If someone gives me a task, I'm like a goldfish. Sometimes I forget what I've done 5 minutes ago. So I have to write it down as quickly as possible, or on a to-do list, or... But then they won't see the bigger problem, like the bigger issues that we can solve, big problems just like that. But what you've asked, big problem. I've had misappraisals, in my opinion. I've been unfairly dismissed from companies because people have not given the patience to explain, or me to explain my conditions properly, or when they think you can't write reports properly. So you come back with a whole report, just so many changes. That doesn't give you any confidence to grow, or shows they're almost like a fixed mindset with other people. They're not prepared to see a different way of thinking.
Yeah, that must be so frustrating. You know, you've got the technical knowledge, but actually somebody's not prepared to work with you. You know, in this day and age where we've got a skills shortage, that people can't find ways of getting the best out of the people that they've got in their teams.
We talk about, you know, say diverse thoughts, and we have all this trying to come up with a good solution for the clients and a cost effective solution. There's things I can't do, you know, as I alluded to, but there are far more things I can do, being double chartered, that has been demonstrated because I'm double chartered, as a chartered engineer, chartered geologist, that I can offer more to a client than I can't, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, you've mentioned there about limitations on progress. Is there any reason why somebody suffering from autism couldn't be an effective leader?
I got no idea. I struggle with that, because we maybe have this stereotype of impression in civil engineering consultancy what a leader should be. And during lockdown, I was questioning this, what a leader was. Was it someone from the top-down leadership, or was it grassroots activists trying to promote change that way? But I see it's like middle up, or middle across, middling out almost. That people like Gary and myself, who are sort of middle of the company, we can influence directors. So at the moment, I'm advising directors, help mentoring junior staff, and I'm trying to be that bridge between directorships and junior staff.
Yeah, well, I suppose we spoke earlier about on the autism spectrum, some people will have reduced social skills. They'll be they'll be quite introverted. Yeah. And you spoke about Big Bang Theory and maybe that's kind of reflected in restrictions in terms of management opportunities. But I think we need to be careful that single point shouldn't define you as a manager. Yeah. And each individual will be quite different.
Yeah. And as autistic people, I've been branded, oh, you've got no communication skills, you've got no social skills, or you've got no emotional intelligence. Yeah, I've been crying out, you know, for my peers to have more emotional intelligence, because I think I've got a lot of emotional intelligence to just emphasize what people are going through. I may not emphasize directly how a classical emotional intelligent person should be, but if someone's hurting, I will feel that pain. And I think that's, there needs to be a lot of, in the workplaces, maybe a lot of time and trust to develop relationships. If you want a good working team, maybe we lack soft skills as engineers. We focus so much on the technical skills as a leader and not these soft skills to develop.
Well, I think you're demonstrating here, and I know you've done webinars and lectures in the past, that you're a confident and effective communicator.
That's me working on my weaknesses and trying to demonstrate that I can do these things. And this doesn't come easy for me, but I think it's just working hard at your weaknesses. Because in the past, I would say my chargership was held back about 7 years, but I don't want to say too much because of whining too much about if people are listening. I don't think they would be, but I don't.
I don't think we want to dwell on negativity, but it is clearly relevant to the industry's perspective on these conditions.
The ICU has only recently changed their process to be chartered, and there's a lot of hurdles that way to get to launch your application, because you can get daunted by all the paperwork you need to do, and not about because you're comparing yourself to other people. And I think you should never compare yourself to someone else. You can't walk in my shoes or Gary's shoes. You've got to walk in your own shoes to you get charged.
So you do think that the industry is making some progress?
Yeah, it's very slow. And I think because our voice is being heard, but I think we need more role models to stand up. And there must be people hiding or masking their conditions, maybe. There needs to be more people. Because if it's 12% of the population, we've got to be at least 12%.
Of course, yeah. So how do we progress from here? There was an event that the British Geotechnical Association Early Careers Group held on this topic recently, I know, because Gary, lectured there or organised it?
Organised it, facilitated it. Just saw it as like the next sort of move, basically. I'd ironically noticed a couple of people online who were on LinkedIn we've connected with, and they were sort of commenting or liking things related to dyslexia and dyspraxia. So I just contacted them privately and said, I'm going to do this article with Martin. It's going to go in Grand Engineering. We'd like to sort of bring together some engineers from different companies and, you know, have a bit of a workshop, have a chat and share experiences see where we can take it, you know. So that's what we did. It was in September now, quite a while ago.
Is it still available online?
So the workshop was in person and it was recorded by somebody from Grand Engineering by hand. And they've started to write the article. Myself and Emily are sort of going to critique it and then push it back around everybody else. And then there'll be kind of some lessons learned. So hopefully it'll be like a round table of people, shared their experiences. We didn't want to do it online because we wanted it to be like a safe space where people could discuss things that, you know, could potentially be sort of sensitive or, you know, we weren't sure how people were going to react, to be honest. Some of the stories were quite emotive, to be fair. And yeah, I think it was the right way to do it. So I think we had about 12 people who attended in the end, from director level, sort of all the way down to sort of junior engineer, which was really, really good. And from different countries as well, interestingly, you know.
And these were all people with learning
difficulties. Yeah, with learning difficulties.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And, And one of the people actually had a daughter with a learning difficulty as well. So obviously seeing it from his perspective gave a slightly different angle as well. So yeah, you know, that was really interesting. And off the back of that, we want to do this podcast, raise more awareness. And then we're going to look and see if we can maybe get some sort of network going as well. There are a couple that are around already, but we wanted to see what people's appetite was for this sort of thing. You know, do they just want to meet up once and then that's it, or are they happy to meet up a few more times and then, you know, see where we can kind of push the message a little bit more? Because, you know, as Martin said, you need more people to talk about this, and that there aren't that many at the moment. And the more people that can talk about it, you can, you know, affect more people in different companies and kind of spread the message, you know, to a wider audience and sort of hopefully make a difference as well.
Yeah, because the interesting you say there about a network and that there is something, because Martin and I first connected, it was off the back of an article that Martin had written, but within the Ground Forum, we were looking to get a more diverse range of voices, and we couldn't find any group that was really supporting people in the construction industry with learning difficulties. So it's interesting that there is something out there. The group that you're referring to, is that within the geotechnical sector or the wider construction industry, or just the society
Yeah, so I was looking at trying to just make it sort of geotechnical focused for the moment, because I know there are sort of construction focused areas as well. But, you know, we're a small niche area, that there aren't that many people who do ground engineering compared to sort of civils. And yeah, you know, I've heard a few stories about how things have happened in different workplaces and stuff. And I just thought, yeah, you know, we need to try and address this. So we're quite sort of lucky with the BGAECG, you know, we're able to be quite nimble and sort of, you know, push agendas where we want to with a lot of support from sort of Ground Engineering magazine as well, which we're really grateful to. So, you know, we feel like we're making a difference and highlighting these issues to, you know, the audience. And yeah, you know, in the workshop, it was really nice because, you know, one person said she hadn't told anybody at work. You know, she was just using her screen in a way that wasn't very helpful to her. There's different settings that you can use, but she didn't want to put the blue screen on because she didn't want somebody to walk around and go, you know, why are you using a blue screen? But I think off the back of the workshop, I met that person a few weeks later at another BGAECG event. And yeah, you know, I think she told me she shared it with her boss. And I think, you know, she's now a lot more comfortable. And you know, just knowing that there are other people in other companies in similar situations gives them a bit of strength and, you know, it's a bit of support, even though we're not sat next to each other. But, you know, I think that's been, you know, quite useful, and it showed that it can help as well. So
yeah,
it's kind of,
well, I think we've got this amazing community within the ground engineering geotechnical sector. So yeah, if you've got that commonality on both points in terms of the work that we're doing and the learning difficulties that you have, then
yeah,
it makes sense to bring it together. So, Rebecca, could you perhaps tell us a little bit about when you became aware of the learning difficulties that you have, and maybe a bit about your journey through education and into the workplace?
So I think we've always known that I've had dyslexia. Even from when I was young, my parents always asked the question of, oh, is she dyslexic? Because it's one of those things that is quite predominant in my family. So I've got an auntie that's got a formal diagnosis. My dad has definitely got dyslexia, but hasn't had the diagnosis just because of his age. And so throughout school, my parents always asked the question, is she dyslexic? And quite sadly, teachers would always say that I was too smart to be dyslexic. But then in reports and that kind of thing, it was always, oh, Rebecca could improve on her spelling. She gets distracted. She daydreams. All very characteristics of having dyslexia. And it was only until when I was about 16 going into my GCSEs that my parents finally privately funded the dyslexia test, and I had dyslexia. And then from there, I kind of got the support that I needed. But without that, well, I went through basically my whole school life without it.
Yeah, it sounds like there's almost like a stigma around it, that maybe family, and we heard it a little bit, I don't want to put words into Gary's mouth, but a little bit from his family, really reluctant to say, no, you are dyslexic, because I suppose the way that society has treated people with those conditions, and I think that's possibly held you back during your learning experiences at school. How did things change once you were able to identify that? And did you go to university? And
yes,
what kind of adjustments were made during your uni days?
So I think when I was at school, it was more for my exams. I was given extra time for my exams. I was also given a reader. So part of dyslexia, when you're reading, sometimes you need that audio as well to kind of back up what you're reading. So I had a reader, and I've had a reader throughout all my exams through uni, and I've just finished my last accounting exam, and I had a reader throughout those as well, along with the extra time. So that really definitely helps. And then from like a personal adjustment side of things, and in my work life, I use a lot of software. So I have dyslexia software. I have a read and write software that's really, really good. It reads to you, it can change the colours of the screen, text, that kind of thing. And that kind of helps me on a day-to-day basis. But I had that at uni as well, which was really good, especially when you've got lots of reading to do. And you can click a button.
If you were doing some coursework or writing a letter, would you tend to dictate it then? Is that an easier way to...
If I'm working from home, I'll dictate my emails, but you can't really chat to yourself in the office.
Might look a little bit mad. Yeah. I must admit, if I'm at home, I would tend to do it. If I was writing a big report or something. I mean, you still need to go back in and change things, but it's quite a good, effective way to get words on the screen very quickly. And then sort of transition into work. I wonder, would you even made public that you had dyslexia? And I think you mentioned ADHD as well, potentially. Is that something that is those conditions asked about on application forms? It's been 25 years since I applied for Jarbury, probably. So I'm not sure what the standard practices these days within a big business like Balfour Beatty. Do people ask about that?
So when I started at Balfour and applied, I'd applied about 4 years ago. I didn't flag it at the start just because of the stigma, and I wasn't necessarily aware of how companies support people with neurodiverse conditions. Whereas now, 4 years later, I 100% would flag myself and say, yep, I need the extra support. I need maybe the questions earlier before the interview so I have time to process them, because with neurodiversity, sometimes your processing time is a little bit slower. So you need that time to prepare a good answer, not even like prepare a good answer. It's just being able to know what you're asking, and you need that time. Yeah, now I'm really open about it. I don't hide behind it, but that's because there's been such a change in the culture, especially within Balfour Beatty. It's a topic that we talk about a lot now. And so there would be nothing to hide. I would not gain anything hiding my quirks.
Well, you've already owned it because you've created, I think you're the one that's created the employee resource group within Balfour Beatty. Can you explain what they do?
Yeah, so we now have a neurodiversity affinity group, which kind of is or started as a branch off of our ability network that we have. And we kind of saw it as an opportunity to have neurodiversity in its own right, because it is such a big topic and it affects people every day, as well as all of the other disabilities. But because they're what you've got about 1 in 7 people in the UK with a neurodiverse condition, and in construction, we think that's way more just because of the nature. So we kind of gave it its own group. And I was lucky enough to be the one leading that after doing reverse mentoring with our chief technology officer, and that kind of, I had then senior leadership support. He then became our sponsor, and now we're a group of over 100 members.
So why would it be any higher? That's just interesting to pick up on. Why do you suspect it's higher within the construction industry? What would lead neurodiverse people to choose construction?
I think it's more of a historical thing of back in the day, if you were dyslexic or you had autism, ADHD, you were kind of labelled as either weird, thick, stupid. People didn't really understand it. So what did you go and do? You went and sought a career that was a bit more physical. It's how it kind of was back in the day. People see a neurodiverse condition and don't see it for how good it is. They always look at the bad bits.
Well within the article that Gary and Martin wrote for GE, they were talking about some of the people through history that have had neurodiverse conditions. So this reading from this, we've got Richard Branson, Leonardo da Vinci, Albert Einstein even, and Elon Musk. So pretty good company there. That's brilliant. So your group is 100 strong, which amazing. So you have regular meetings. How's it work? Was it more ad hoc in terms of some of the communication?
So we kind of set ourselves, like, we live by four pillars within the network, which then means we meet regularly to kind of keep the churn for those pillars. So the first one is all about reasonable adjustments, which is what we focus on day to day, I would say, that probably has the most benefit. The second one is about educating people, which over the past year, we have worked really, really hard on trying to educate the business and wider business on what is neurodiversity and what that really means, and kind of break those stereotypes around certain conditions. Then the third one is about recruitment. So we look to recruit the best people, as well as making it accessible for everyone. Because notoriously, the recruitment process does filter out neurodiverse people, especially if you're using those psychometric testing that people do. I know I had to do it when I started as a graduate here, and that does, it's against everything neurodiversity, I would say. So we're trying really hard to make sure that our recruitment process is suitable for everyone. And then the last one is all about support. So supporting people, whether they are formally diagnosed, self-diagnosed, have children who have got neurodiverse conditions, or are just a general ally and want to support the wider network in neurodiversity topics.
That's brilliant. So that's within Balfour Beatty itself. Mm-hmm. Is there any plans to kind of expand that network, or maybe provide it as a case study to other businesses? Mm-hmm. Would you be able to do that perhaps?
Yeah, so part of what we did last year / the year before is that we worked with Sunbelt to create EcoSense cabins, which are B-rated cabins, but they have been adapted to suit neurodiversity needs. So they have dimmable lighting, they have better soundproofing, they have colours on the walls rather than just your bright white, all things that help people with a neurodiverse condition. So they've won awards, and that was kind of the start of how we work with our supply chain to help people with neurodiverse conditions. But we don't stop there. We are now part of Neurodiversity in Business, which is the charity that has a lot of corporate members, as well as other companies that are a lot smaller. So we're a part of it, but you've also got companies like IBM that are part of it, EY, Lloyds. You know, you've got some real big companies there, and we all come together to talk about neurodiversity and promote awareness of neurodiversity and how people can make small adjustments that would have a really big effect.
Brilliant. Gary, Martin, have you got any questions for Rebecca about the group at all? I'll give you the opportunity to come in.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why we asked her to get involved in this, to be fair. Yeah, I mean, how many people did you start off with to get from sort of 0, 1 or 2 to 100, and how long did it take? Because obviously you do have a churn in people. People join things they don't have the time because you're volunteering. How did you get to that 100, and how long did it take, I guess?
So we started, it was myself and then about 4 others. And then it just kind of grew where we had our soft launch. We have a company social media platform called Yammer. So we have our own Yammer group. And then from there, people can post and you can kind of put out information about the group and what we're doing a lot easier. And then over the past year, it's grown to over 100. So we've only been going for about a year to 18 months officially.
Okay, that's really good.
Yeah, it's interesting. Obviously, this is a geotechnical ground engineering podcast, but it's important that we borrow ideas from other sectors, obviously still within the construction industry. Are there, and I suppose this is open to all three of our guests, is there sectors out there that are market leading when it comes to this, or are we all kind of in the same place on the journey?
I think it honestly depends on how vocal that company is. You might say they're a market leader, but then when you go work for a company, they might not put what they advertise into practice. So it's hard to say. I think, yeah. And also it comes down to money, obviously. So you've got leaders in this, I would say, again, EY, huge auditing company. They promote neurodiversity so much. They've got a neurodiversity center of excellence, which speaks volumes.
Yeah, it's incredible. Ernst & Young, I guess you're referring to that. We did say earlier that about the tech industry, where those skills seem to be particularly appreciated. The skills that come with Asperger's, for instance.
Yeah.
Gary, you wanted to comment?
Yeah, although it's just an example of neurodiversity, because I can't remember what I was going to say. I was just about to write it down and I was going to say
I'm sure it was absolutely brilliant.
I think I was going to say something. Oh, the government. Yeah, I think the government are actually doing a lot. Like, I think, like the security services, I'm sure I've read articles about like intelligence, MI5, MI6, and they've done lots of screening tests, and they've had, I don't know, 50 people in a room, and you do all these tests to work something out, and somebody who's neurodiverse has managed to crack it in like 10 minutes, and non-neurodiverse people, it's taken them an hour. So that's, quite a good example of where somebody neurodiverse can be very, very useful, and they've been singled out for their skills. There's that film with Alan Turing in as well, isn't there? I'm sure.
Imitation Game, is that the one?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and I'm sure a lot of those people were neurodiverse. They just didn't have the diagnosis at that point in time, but they could crack a puzzle very, very quickly. So
yeah.
If they've got the money and they're looking for the right skills, I think people will invest in it. I think something that we did discuss in the workshop, which kind of Rebecca kind of alluded to, was I think I called it EDI sort of washing, which is people saying they do one thing and then in reality not doing anything, and they're just kind of using it to tick boxes so that they can get through sort of procurement portals and stuff like that. So I think it is only when you can ask people who work for those companies that you can really get a measure of whether or not people are making a difference or not. Obviously, Bafflebee sounds like they're doing amazing things.
I'd rather see case studies than sort of policies. I think when it comes to EDI and lots of other things.
Glossy marketing. It's easy to dress something up. But when you start to probe and sort of question, I think... you start to see the reality of what's there. So, I mean, there are so many competing things for companies. I am sympathetic to them. There's so many different issues that they have to address and put time and effort into to kind of reach everybody and, the whole workforce. And it is hard to put that time and that resource and money into it. So.
Well, through this hour that we've spent together, I've really learned a lot more about neurodiversity, and I suppose one of the key takeaways is that actually how important it is to have neurodiverse people within your teams, because that way you're going to be more effective as a group. So thank you all for sharing your knowledge about the topic with us, and look forward to keeping in touch with you over the months and years ahead. I really enjoyed making this episode. If you think there's a topic we should be covering or have a suggestion for a guest, please contact me, Steve Hadley, through my LinkedIn profile.